Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Helen Benedict, whose latest novel is Sand Queen. Helen Benedict is author of 10 books, 5 novels, and 5 books of nonfiction. The most recent nonfiction book is The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. Helen Benedict is a journalist who teaches at Columbia, is that correct?
Yes, the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University.
As I was telling you before we went on the air, I picked up Sand Queen and couldn't put it down. What it seemed to do, and I guess this was your goal, was put the reader into the mind of a female soldier in Iraq in 2003 and a woman Iraqi in 2003 as well, in a way that nonfiction can't.
Yeah, because the role of fiction is to go into the human soul and to go into the places where real people are often reluctant to either talk about or even look into or are unable to. So I did, for the other book you mentioned, The Lonely Soldier, I did interview some 40 women who'd served in Iraq with different branches of the military. But as open as they were with me, there were still those moments when they fell silent or their eyes would fill with tears or they'd deflect questions with jokes or start to shake. And in those silences, I knew that there was another story going on, one that they couldn't or wouldn't talk about, which was the interior experience of living through a war, what it really felt like and what you really thought privately. And so that's why I needed to turn to fiction, because that's the territory of fiction.
And the decision to bring in an Iraqi woman.
After all, you know, this war has two sides, and we've paid a fair amount of attention to our soldiers and the trauma they've been through. There's been a lot of media attention about post-traumatic stress disorder, all of which is important and good, and I've been part of that myself. But there is the other side, and the Iraqi civilians who have been so decimated by this war, creating millions of refugees and hundreds of thousands of deaths. And there's been, you know, enormous amount of maiming and birth defects as a result of the pollution of war, the poisons of war, and the bombs themselves. I'm very aware of the stereotype, the general stereotype about Iraqi women and how inaccurate it is here. So I wanted to address that head-on by bringing an Iraqi woman of education, a medical student, father professor, mother a doctor, alive, and make her as human as our friends are human, so that we can all see both sides and to counteract some stereotypes.
But you don't plot in advance. So when you created the characters, you weren't sure about what their interactions would be?
Well, I did have an idea of why they would meet and how, and I did have an idea of the pivotal event in the novel, because it came out of something a real soldier, had told me. I mean, she hadn't experienced the exact story, but it gave me the idea for the story. So I just knew, say, the climax of the story in the beginning, and that was all I knew when I began to write, and the rest of it just came out of the characters.
What was the true story that this is based on?
Yeah, one of the women I interviewed was a prison guard in the first and biggest American prisoner of war camp in Iraq, which was called Camp Buka, right by the Kuwait border. And she told me that her first job was to man, we don't even have a name for it, woman the checkpoint, and that Iraqi civilians would come every morning at dawn to find out what had happened to their brothers and sons and husbands and who had been arrested by us and put into this huge prison, and that some of them could speak English. And so early in the war, there would be interaction between the soldiers and the civilians. Sometimes they would chat or they would trade sunflower seeds for jewelry. And that gave me the idea of how Kate and Naima could meet. And Naima would speak English and make a deal with Kate. This all happens at the beginning of the novel, where she says, I'll interpret for you and help you deal with the crowd if in exchange you take my photograph of my father and brother who've been arrested and find them and tell me if they're alive and safe.
It seemed to me as I was reading the book that later on in the novel, you might have originally intended for more interaction, but what happens in a novel is that the characters take over and do their own thing. Is that kind of what happened here?
Partly, but I also wanted to be realistic. it would not have been realistic to have Kate and Naima become best buddies and see each other all the time. That would have been impossible. That just doesn't happen in the war. It was realistic that they could meet and have an initial interaction. And it was realistic that they could have an effect on each other's lives that's very profound that neither of them even know, but the reader knows. So it wasn't so much a surprise to me that the way it evolved, because I know enough about how the war works and what it was like there from all my interviewing and research to have been really sure about wanting to keep it realistic and plausible. I didn't want any soldier reading this or any Iraqi reading this and saying, ha, that never would have happened. That's very important to me that I get it accurate.
Well, that, there's a reason for that, and that for me, in some ways, though it's fiction, the feelings are the feelings of reading a nonfiction book in a way that nonfiction can't bring it alive.
Well, it should be. Fiction should be like that. You should feel as if you know the people, you really are getting to know the people you're reading about, or even that you are them. And this is the beauty of fiction. You know, it allows you to flee your own life, your own skin, and enter the lives and skins of other people. So I wanted that effect.
But there's an element that I find with other fiction writers, and that I think is different in Sand Queen, Helen Benedict, and that's that with fiction writers, they'll say, well, you know, if it's a choice between telling the facts and giving a sense of truth, the truth is more important. In this one, I felt in a way that what you were doing is by creating a fictional view, you still wanted to say very much within the context of fact.
Yes, well, that's an interesting comment. I think what I wanted to do, as I said, was keep it completely plausible. That's the fact part.
Right.
But I wanted to get to a deeper truth than I could even get to in my nonfiction work with this subject. And I don't think they have to be contradictory. But what I did need was the freedom to invent characters and invent a story to get to that deeper truth, because it would have been very hard to get any soldier or Iraqi to tell me about their really deep feelings. And anyway, things happen. They don't know what the other one is doing when they're not out in sight, just
right,
like in real life. And that's what the beauty of being a narrator. You kind of play God, and you can make things happen, and people affect each other that they don't even know.
Well, this is all set against the background of things that did happen and people you did interview. So I'd like to go into some of the details that just simply, you know, stunned me, because I haven't read your nonfiction. And while I keep up all the time, you can't keep up with everything. Rape plays a major part in this book. And I understand that, in fact, you wrote a play about it. There's a class action suit against the Pentagon by women who were in the Army. And I would assume that's because the Army refused to deal with rape.
Yes, the class action suit is on behalf of 15 women and 2 men, in fact, who were sexually assaulted and or raped in the military, not just the Army. And it was inspired partly by The Lonely Soldier, my nonfiction book, which does talk a lot about the rates of sexual harassment and assault and rape within the military of women soldiers and male soldiers, perpetrated by their comrades, you know, not by the enemy, not by outsiders. The statistics are horrifying. Somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 3 women are sexually assaulted while serving by their comrades.
There's a scene where 2 soldiers assault Kate. It felt as if that scene might have happened with, you know, different people, but in real life.
It isn't an exact replica of any one story I heard, any more than the characters are. They're not
right.
Conglomerate characters. They're not disguised real people. But I heard many, 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 many stories of rape. It's heartbreaking. So, you know, I didn't repeat any particular one of them. But this, again, it's all could have happened, even if those people aren't real. And for all I know, there's somebody out there, and I inadvertently described something that, you know, specifically
right.
that happened.
At one point, Kate goes to the bathroom and sees these horrendous epithets on the wall, including Sand Queen. Now, is Sand Queen an actual term that
yes.
they use?
Well, that did come from the story of a real soldier to whom that happened. And another soldier told me what Sand Queen means. It's a derogatory term that's specific to the Iraq War. I think it comes mainly out of the army, and it means an unattractive woman who is the object of a lot of attention from men because women are so scarce anyway, and it goes to her head, and she gets very arrogant, and she also allows herself to be used by these men who wouldn't look at her twice at home. So they're basically, as one soldier said, she's a mattress. I mean, the language they use about women is so horrific. So it's a derogatory term, and I decided to use it not only because somebody says that about Kate, but because it kind of summarizes the denigrating attitude that so many military men have towards military women, alas.
Now, in these tents where they live, I understand that everybody has to be in the same place, but they're not putting the women together. They're separating out the women among the men. And what is the army expecting to happen?
This was true at the beginning of the war, and not in all bases, but it was true at Camp Buka, which was basically just a bunch of tents in the desert. There was almost no equipment at the beginning of the war. They had to build their own latrines, and they were all living in tents. So there certainly wasn't the money or equipment to build separate barracks for women. And since there were so few women anyway, they couldn't be bothered. That happened later on, and other bases were better equipped. But it was quite common at the beginning of the war for men and women to all be sharing the same digs.
In an essay you wrote, you said military culture is fiercely secretive and self-protective, and soldiers who criticize it are treated as traitors, and whistleblowers tend to internalize the accusation, which means that Kate, the real Kates of the world, or the real Third Eyes or Yvettes, can't even complain that the soldier next to them is masturbating to them.
No, because they'll be seen as whiners and as weak soldiers. If you're a soldier, you should be able to handle things yourself. Just like any really enclosed society, there's a fierce loyalty that grows up, and you're seen as a traitor if you report anybody for wrongdoing, and that's considered worse in many cases than actually sexually assaulting someone. Talk about being a traitor. But in the values of the military, it's commonly thought that women ask for it and invite it, so they should handle it, and it's the blaming of the victim, and then the internalizing self-blame is a common outcome of this.
Well, Kate goes running in the morning, and it's policy to run with someone. Is that to protect them from Iraqis or to protect them from soldiers? Because if it's to protect them from soldiers, then the army knew the rape was going on.
Oh, sure it does. Very aware. It is both. But there's a rule that came down very early in the war where women were not allowed to go to the latrines or to the showers, which are often far away from where they're sleeping, without a battle buddy, supposed to be another woman, to protect them from the men on their own side. Which is ironic for many reasons. The obvious ones are why need protection from your own comrades, but the other one is there very often isn't another woman to be your battle buddy.
So they're stuck in this place where anything could happen unless they find a male protector. But they don't want a male protector because it makes them look weak.
Right. And they're furious because men don't have this rule. I had so many women soldiers say, wait a minute, you bring me here as a soldier, you tell me I'm equal, and then I'm not allowed to go through the latrine without having to search for somebody to go with me? What is this? What kind of respect is this? Another woman told me about her battle buddy having to be a guy because there are no women around, and he said to her on the way, what would you do if I raped you? You know, so she said, I'm carrying a knife. I heard so many stories of women carrying weapons more with the idea of protecting themselves against the men on their own side.
There's a sequence where someone actually reports a rape and is then sent on a suicide mission. How common was that?
Well, I heard that sort of story a lot. And that's part of the class action suit, is because too many people who've reported rape, men and women, have been met with threats of punishment or actual punishment rather than judicial action.
And in that case, it was a woman who turned her back on other women.
Yes.
Is that common?
It is common. As with any oppressed group who haven't had a chance to evolve much yet, there tends to be a great deal of competition and distrust between women to make it, because it's so much harder to win respect as a female trooper than it is as a male. As one of them said to me, you have to be twice as bad as the boys. So the distrust and suspicion among and competition among women is sometimes more upsetting to the women than the way the men behave, depending on their particular platoon and the dynamics. But just because they're women doesn't mean they're all going to support each other, I'm afraid.
Was Camp Booker a worst-case scenario at the time in 2003, or was it more or less standard operating procedure even then?
In terms of male,
in terms of the horrors that you describe in San Quentin?
I would say it was standard because I heard these stories from people in all the branches, in all different circumstances, in all different years of the war. I mean, Camp Booker was more primitive at the beginning of the war than some other camps, as I said, in terms of its physical conditions. But in terms of how men and women treat each other, no, it was very standard.
And the story of the tower, guarding the prisoners and what the prisoners did, I take it that comes from things that you heard
yes,
as well.
Yes, not only things that soldiers told me, but there were two TV documentaries done on it. Dan Rather, I think, did something. So it was pretty well documented that the Iraqi detainees would throw things, especially at the female soldiers, whatever they could. Snakes and scorpions and worse things and stones. Prisoners do this in a lot of places, but all the conditions at Camp Booker that I describe in the novel come from interviews, documentations, and a governmental report called the Taguba Report that delineated many of the conditions. So it's pretty well researched.
The food that they were eating, these horrible packets of food that just stop you up. You think that was intentional on the Army so that they didn't have to go to
that? They still eat that stuff. The MREs. Yes, it is intentional because they're constipating on purpose so that soldiers don't have to go to the bathroom so much when they're out in theater, as it's called.
And dehydration is pretty common as well.
Yes, because the desert heat is unbelievable out there. It can go up as high as 140. Can you imagine? And you're wearing 80 pounds of gear and thick uniforms and bulletproof vests and flak jackets. So soldiers are passing out from dehydration all the time. They have to drink and drink and drink all the time to remember. And it's quite common. Oh, I remember one soldier telling me she was afraid to drink very much because she was afraid to go to the latrines at night because of the fear of being raped. So she was passing out all the time. She said she had IV track lines on her arms from being rehydrated so often.
The abuse of the soldiers by the military and by each other, it makes something like Abu Ghraib a lot more comprehensible.
Yes, because if you can't treat each other right, you can see how that would spill over very quickly into not treating the detainees right and not treating Iraqis right. I mean, I do feel that the Iraq war, because of the mandates from the government, the permission to torture, the lack of a clear mission, trying to run the war on the cheap and treating soldiers badly, not even giving them enough armor and so on at the beginning under Cheney, all of that erodes one's moral compass, as soldiers like to say, and it makes it more possible to be abusive towards others.
And it also seems that as these soldiers have more issues while they're in Iraq with post-traumatic stress, there's no one to help them at all and no way for them to even do anything about it other than slip further and further into the disorder.
That's true while they're there. I will say that quite a lot of veterans come home, and if they have real moral problems with what they did and with the war, which many do, one relief is to become an activist. So I do know a lot of soldiers who've either become activists on the part of veterans' rights or working with wounded vets or peace activists or against the war. So when they come home, they can do something. But when they're on active duty and under orders, they can't, or they just end up being court-martialed and thrown in the brig.
How common was it, as happens to Kate, that her disconnect from her family grows and grows, so she wants nothing to do with them because they're totally clueless?
Yes, that's quite common. I mean, a lot of the soldiers that we've used in this war came straight out of high school and were very young. Quite a lot of them joined up when they were so young they needed their parents to sign a waiver. You know, they were 17. And when they get there and they find out that they're not liberating and that people and they're not helping, they will get angry at the adults who encourage them or allow them to do this, even if it's not always rational, their anger. but they will be very angry, and they'll also come home, and as soldiers have done since the beginning of time, feel that civilians won't understand what they've been through and why they're feeling the way they feel, or want to protect the people they love from knowing what they really did, because they don't want to conflict the trauma on the people they love, or they don't want to be seen as a monster, and some of them feel that they've been turned into monsters. There are many reasons why they fall into silence, but the anger is huge, both internal and external.
Some of Kate's reactions when she gets back in the VA hospital in terms of walking out on the group therapy session, how common is that?
I heard that a lot from women, because women from the Iraq War in particular, but also Afghanistan, are in this unique position of being combat veterans and often sexual assault survivors. So they've got this double trauma, and from previous wars, there are very few women who are ground combat veterans. They either find themselves in therapy groups with combat veterans and there who are all men, which is very hard for any woman, but especially if she's been sexually assaulted, or they find themselves with women, none of whom saw combat, so they feel quite alienated from them.
Hajis, that's common for how they term Iraqis.
Yes, I mean, it's a term of respect, meaning somebody who's made the pilgrimage to Mecca and come back. But soldiers have turned it into a derogatory term for all Iraqis.
The other side of the story is the side of Naima, who is an Iraqi medical student who is with her family, and two members of her family are taken away by the U.S. military, and she needs to deal with that. I don't think people in America understand how destructive American presence was to the country of Iraq and the culture.
Yeah. There is this idea that, and we've partly been fed this, but it's also just from lack of information, that the Iraqi women in particular were no different than Saudi Arabian women or women in Afghanistan under the Taliban, not allowed to go to school, under the veil, completely oppressed, forgetting that Iraq was a secular country under Saddam Hussein. Women could dress as they wished. Especially women lived in Baghdad. They were lawyers, they were doctors, they were politicians, they were engineers. 40% of the workforce was women, 50% of the students were women. They had more rights than any Muslim women in the world outside of Turkey, all of which has gone backwards since the war. So I wanted readers to meet an Iraqi woman who is sophisticated and educated and counter to that stereotype of being a sort of illiterate wife having millions of children and being shut up in the house, which is so inaccurate about Iraqis.
The little things just floored me. Baghdad is a city of trees, and yet Naima complains that virtually all the trees are now gone.
Yeah. Yeah, the trees were bombed, mowed down. I mean, Iraq had beautiful orange and date groves all over, and many of which were plowed under just as an act of war, and thereby not only ruining the landscape, but ruining sources of food and farmers' livelihoods.
And Baghdad itself has been badly damaged.
Oh, hugely. And what a beautiful city it once was. Yeah, its bridges smashed. And
had you been to Baghdad before the war?
No. Yeah, I just know from pictures and films and documentaries, and I also read a lot of Iraqi literature, anything I could find translated. I don't speak Arabic, to get a sense of, you know, what Baghdad was like before and what it's like during and what it's like now. And I found a lot of Iraqi blogs I've been following, so I got my sources from that, also Iraqi poetry, to get Naima's voice and to get the details of what she might be missing.
And I take it her father, the professor, while not an individual that actually exists, is based on several people and what happened to them.
Yeah, I mean, again, not directly based on anybody, but informed by is a better way of putting it.
And he's a professor who writes poetry and was tortured by Saddam Hussein, and then along comes the Americans, and he might or might not be tortured again.
Yeah. We threw a lot of people into prison who had spent their lives opposing Saddam, and we weren't paying attention. We either couldn't understand them or we didn't care. There was a lot of sweeping up of randomly of civilians and throwing them in Camp Buka at the beginning of the war. So it's the irony that we were imprisoning and abusing some of the very people who were on our side.
And a lot of them, I would take it, eventually had to turn anti-American, which means that it was all counterproductive.
Absolutely.
The tragedy of Iraq and the tragedy now of Afghanistan as well is that America really doesn't know what the hell it's doing.
No. And we're not finding a solution or a good way out either. I mean, there's this terrible dilemma. The more we're there, the more we enrage certain people and create violence. But we've also caused this terrible disorder that we have some obligation to try and sort out. I happen to think we shouldn't be using the military for any of this. We should certainly be in there funding, rebuilding, and helping with infrastructure, but not forgetting that Iraqis were some of the leading engineers in the world. I mean, they're very accomplished people. There's no need for us to do it and pay Americans to do it. We should be paying them or helping them, not just America, but other countries who are involved in this war, helping them build their own country back up.
Helen Benedict, I found on your website a review of the movie Restrepo, and in that you criticize the film because you say, do not fall in love with your sources, and that's why embedding is dangerous.
That's right. Yeah, I call that review War, a Love Story, Restrepo. The danger with embedding is that you put a journalist in with a platoon of soldiers. The journalist is not allowed to carry a weapon, so the journalist is dependent on the soldiers to guard and protect his or her life, usually his. On top of it all, soldiers play this game with civilians and journalists, which is, you know, we're tough guys, we're the macho soldiers, and you're just a wimp with the camera. And we've got our in jokes, and, you know, we're not sure we'll let you in. And then gradually as time goes on, you know, they might start being nicer or accept the journalist, and the journalist feels like, oh, I've been let into the man's club. And, you know, and then a lot of guys, of course, were quite in love with the idea of soldiers when they were little boys and playing. So it plays into that. I need to be accepted by these macho men so that I can feel like one too. And before you know it, you're really beholden and dependent on and even admiring the soldiers that you're covered, and you lose all objectivity. Not to mention, you're censored. When you're embedded, your work is often looked at by a commander. So, I mean, imagine if you were covering a corrupt corporation and you were sent to live with the CEO, you know, go to dinner with him, spend weekends with him, get to know his wife, hang out, go to the pool, go to the strip club, whatever these people do, and then you're supposed to write an objective story. It's absurd.
Well, it seemed to me back in 2002 and 2003 when I saw the embedded reporters and read their reports, it struck me from the beginning the Bush administration knew all that, and this was all deliberate.
Oh, absolutely.
It seemed like a total con.
It actually was invented by the Brits and Falklands as a way of controlling the press. And then we saw it and imitated it here, and it's gone back and forth. It's all about controlling the press. It's all about making sure that Vietnam doesn't happen again, where the press went in independently, told it like it really is, put the images up on the TV screens, and fed the protest.
There are a few movies that are fiction that deal with Iraq, because let's face it, not many people see documentaries. One of them won an Oscar, The Hurt Locker, and another is Green Zone. What do you think of those films?
I don't like them at all. I prefer Green Zone, actually, but I think The Hurt Locker was just a cowboy movie dressed up as soldiers with all the same old Hollywood values. And there was that one tiny scene when he comes home and he's in the supermarket and he's all bewildered, which everyone clings to as the sort of one criticism of war and comment on PTSD. But compared to his sort of, to the depiction of that hero's outsized courage and, you know, the maverick guy who takes all these risks and saves his soldiers' lives. I mean, it's the oldest story, and you'd never know there was a woman soldier there. All the Iraqis were presented as stereotyped bad guys. I thought it actually glamorized war, and any work of fiction, whatever its medium, that glamorizes war is a lie.
And Green Zone was a little better because at least it showed some corruption.
It did.
It struck me that the best movie about Iraq is still Three Kings.
Yes, that was very good.
Yeah,
and,
Three Kings.
I also really liked The Messenger. I don't know if you saw that one.
Yeah,
just about the two soldiers whose job it was to go to people's houses and tell them that their husbands or sons had been killed, or daughters, although they didn't pay much attention to that in the war, and it didn't show the war itself at all, but it showed the cost of war in a very sensitive way.
Well, the thing about Three Kings is it showed people actually taking advantage of war
for their own
ends.
That was uncannily accurate and prescient. The amount of corruption that's happened in Iraq from our own forces, not to mention the places like Blackwater and Calibert and KBR, I mean, those organizations have been so appalling, they should all be in prison.
So we can go back to Catch-22 and see the same thing all over again.
Yes.
Why did you choose to write a play called The Lonely Soldier Monologues?
Yes, that play came straight out of my interviews with the soldiers. So it was all in their words, the exact words of the soldiers. It wasn't a work of fiction. It might be what you call a documentary play. It may be on at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in May. There might be a reading. There's plans to do it. Why did I do it? Because somebody suggested it, and I thought, you know, these interviews are so dramatic, they would work very well on stage, and then it would reach a different kind of audience than might read a nonfiction book. I didn't have the novel yet. And indeed, it was very moving. 7 women, all different races, ethnic groups, ages, etc., played the women, the soldiers. We carefully matched up the actors with who the soldiers were. And at one point, the actual veterans came. They'd never met the actors before. And they watched the play and they met afterwards. And it was the whole theater was in tears, all the audience in tears. It was so moving. So it was mostly about getting the message out about what was happening in this war and what was happening to women soldiers. I wrote it for free. Nobody was paid. No money was ever made. But it was performed for quite a few weeks in New York, and it got a good review in the Times, and people seemed to have found it moving.
There's a nonfiction book you wrote a while ago called Virgin or Vamp, How the Press Covers Sex Crimes. How do you think working on a book like that impacted your own work in terms of sex crimes in Iraq?
Well, it wasn't the first book I've written about sexual assault and the violence against women. It was the third book I'd written on this subject. And funnily enough, when I first started doing research on soldiers, I didn't know I was wading back into this subject. I was just interested in why would women want to enlist? Why does women want to be in the military? And what's it like for women to actually be in ground combat, as they are in Iraq, even though it's still officially banned? Then when I was interviewing them, I started hearing the stories very quickly, immediately, about the abuse from their men. And I realized, oh, this is this subject that I know. And I think it really helped me interview them sensitively and maybe help them trust me with their stories. Part of my self-education to write about sex crimes was I trained as a rape crisis counselor, just so that I would learn how to interview without re-traumatizing people or hurting them. People who've been through trauma. That's been very useful for me because I think it does mean that people trust me.
Helen Benedict, was there anything that you wanted to put in the book and there was just no place for it?
Yes, I love that question. I had a conversation between Kate and this male soldier who she has a relationship with. I don't want to give too much away because it's complicated. Jimmy, who's a good soul. And it's a conversation about the things that I'm doing as a soldier are making me feel evil. Is it being a soldier in war that's making me do these terrible things? Or was I always like that? And it's with a war that's bringing it out of me. I just didn't know it was there before. And this is a question that I think is a very interesting one for people to wrestle with. But I couldn't make that conversation happen directly in a way that felt natural. So I had to take it out. I wrestled with it for a long time. I took it out because it always started to feel like preaching instead of just, you know, natural. And I let it show more in their actions. However, I'm now writing a sequel to Sand Queen with the same characters. And that idea is more prominent in the second novel. Although, again, nobody actually talks about it quite directly like that. But I think I found a way of tackling that question better.
Well, that also brings up the question of the relationship between activism and journalism. I know journalists are supposed to be objective, quote-unquote, but what happens when you see a horror? How do you maintain, quote, objectivity and at the same time be an activist.
Yes. Journalists aren't supposed to be activists. We're supposed to just give the information and let other people use it for their activism, which was my main goal with The Lonely Soldier, was to give the material and the information to peace activists and to veterans advocates. But I am asked to speak a lot on this subject and with Sand Queen to organizations who see me more as an activist. And I think any reporter who does exposés, and essentially that's what I'm doing really, is a kind of expose, falls into looking like an activist or even an advocate sometimes, because you're pointing out wrongdoing, and that is the role of a journalist. It's just that pointing out of the wrongdoing is researched and fact-checked.
It seems to me that the mainstream or corporate media has just simply not been doing its job in terms of presenting the material. It seems to be maybe more censored, but it's an internal censor, than before, or am I just looking at things through rose-colored glasses?
I think the early coverage by the mainstream media, i.e., in particular the New York Times, but also the Post, of the Iraq War is one of its darkest periods. It's admitted as much. The support for the Bush line, the buying of the WMD story, the lack of criticism over why we went into this war, the lack of questioning, Judith Miller stuff. And I think it has to do with 9/11. I happened to be out of the country during 9/11. I was in France, and I was able to watch what happened in the aftermath of that attack through the eyes of French television, BBC, as well as American TV and press as well. When I came back in 2002, I was really shocked at how entrenched the media had got, and actually further to the right the media had got, including some of my local public radio stations, which had noticeably changed since I left. In August of 2001, I left the country. And there was a kind of fear reaction, and you know that now well-quoted liberal thing about, oh, maybe we should go to war after all, maybe we were wrong, liberal guilt, and just a readiness to a need for revenge and a fear with self-protection. I don't know, but it really distorted. And there was self-censorship. But there was also, this whole decision, don't show the coffins of the soldiers coming back. Even the way 9/11 was covered. I saw on French television the people jumping. But nobody in New York saw that on their televisions. So there was censorship almost instantly, which is so condescending and patronizing to the public.
Do you think things are better now?
I think they are. I do think they are somewhat better. I think the New York Times in particular, I've been living in New York, I'm more focused on that, is doing a pretty good job of covering the mess that this country is now in. But I always feel that we should be paying attention, I also wish Obama would do this for that matter, pay more attention to the lies that are told by political candidates and call a lie a lie. And there is a kind of fear of doing that because it doesn't seem objective, but it's perfectly objective when you can prove something's a lie.
Well, what I see is the word misstatement, which is itself a lie.
Yes.
It's not a misstatement, it's a lie.
Exactly, and that word, we just pussyfoot around, we won't use the word. I mean, honest headlines would be, candidate so-and-so lies again. We should see that every day.
But we also see something which is now, finally has a name, the he said, she said journalism, which has somebody saying, the sky is blue, and the other person saying the sky is green, and for some reason, the press is not allowed to interpret those statements.
Right. The idea of balance has gotten quite distorted. So you can have 100 people saying the sky is blue and one person saying it's green, and it sounds as if it's 50-50 the way it's reported. We talk about that a lot at the journalism school, actually. Students notice this, I'm glad to say. We agree that there's something very distorting about that. We often end up paying attention to a tiny amount of people, who are saying outrageous things because it's catchy, but not because they really represent any sort of majority. And then that gives a distorted impression.
The recent Wall Street demonstrations were barely covered in the print press. They wound up, you know, in like the New York Times online, but not much in print. And there were hundreds, sometimes up to 1,000 or more people, and yet 200 people show up for Sarah Palin, and it's called a big crowd in the Washington Post.
Yes, that is worrying. And you do wonder about the politics behind it. I can say is that the common idea that the press is liberal has never been true, and it certainly isn't true now.
For you as a journalist, what can you do? You testified twice in front of Congress. What was that like?
Terrifying. One of the most nerve-wracking things I've ever done. Congress has actually been holding hearings on the abuse of soldiers by other soldiers for decades, especially since the first Gulf War. And I keep throwing these mandates to the military to do something about it and keeps being ignored. So I was part of that. The first time it was still under Bush, the second time was under Obama, and there was a difference in openness. I was glad they held these testimonies, and we were able to be very frank as we wished to be, and we were treated with great respect by the Congress people listening. But there is this sense of testifying for the record and not for any actual effect, you know, that you're shouting into a kind of void. The military is amazingly unresponsive to Congress. I mean, it really acts sometimes as if it's its own kingdom.
And what about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? How does the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell play into abuse? If people are out of the closet in Iraq, that sounds like another area where bullying could take place.
I would say quite the opposite. Don't Really? Ask, Don't Tell was an official tool of persecution. It had officially allowed people to bully other people. Rapists used it to silence their victims. Men used it to kick out women who were rivaling them in their how well they did their jobs or were threatening them. More women proportionally were kicked out under Don't Ask, Don't Tell than men. So quite aside from persecuting actual gays and lesbians, it was used to persecute anyone you didn't like. Once you give people an institution, an official tool of bullying, it spreads to all kinds of bullying. And that has ended is going to, you know, there might be some trouble, but there already was anyway. There already has been persecution of gays and certain guys, you know, will beat a gay guy up. But there's also a lot of tolerance. You know, let us not forget that the majority of troops, when surveyed, thought that Don't Ask, Don't Tell should be overturned.
In terms of Sand Queen, how many translators were thrown out because they were gay?
Yes. I think it's one of the few really good pieces of news we've seen for a long time. And an analogy is the way the Bush administration allowed torture. You know, if you allow torture officially, then it becomes more and more acceptable to do it unofficially too. So it spreads a kind of corruption within the military, and that's what Don't Ask, Don't Tell did for sure.
Helen Benedict, you've written Sand Queen. You're working on a sequel to Sand Queen. What kind of topics are you covering now as a journalist?
I'm not, because I can only write one book at a time, and I teach full time. So, I mean, I do write the occasional essay or op-ed piece, usually to do with the same subject, to do with the military, the Iraq War, the treatment of women. But I don't do a whole lot of articles on the side as well as write a book and teach.
And what prompted you way back when to become a journalist?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid. And by the time I graduated from school, I realized that nobody made a living writing fiction, which was my first love, except, you know, five people or something, Stephen King and a few others. But I also have always had this political side, this urge, a passion about social justice. And I read Jessica Mitford, who used to live in Oakland, whom I was lucky enough to know. Her books really inspired me because she was able to write exposés as a journalist with wit and elegance and actually change things. And I just thought, I want to do that. So that's sort of what drew me into it.
Do you think you have changed things?
I think somewhat. Virgin or Vamp did inspire some newspapers to draw up guidelines about how to cover sex crimes more sensitively, the Philadelphia Inquirer for one. The Lonely Soldier inspired a class action suit, and I, as we mentioned, and I do know that several people in the Defense Department and several Congress people have read it because they were holding my book when I went to testify, and they said we read it. The Defense Department did, in fact, implement some of the changes I suggested. Mostly, I think, I've affected a few individuals here and there, and I get sometimes very touching emails from people who've been really moved or feel that, oh, this happens to other people, I'm not alone. That's nice, but you never really know whether you'll have a lasting effect. Only time will tell.
You've been listening to an interview with Helen Benedict, whose latest novel is Sand Queen. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.